November 21st, and we're here at the group, Josh Routson, and we're going to interview Bill and her husband, Tim. Milton, but you know, Tim. And we're going to start with Billy. And could you tell us just a little bit about your life before you came to Copenhagen?
Before I was married or after?
Well, just sort of a general where you grew up and how you came to meet Tim and then come to Copenhagen.
Well, my dad was in the Navy, and home was wherever Daddy dropped his hat. And he, fortunately for me, he went to Norfolk, Virginia one time, and I was a cheerleader. Tim was a football player, and I was cheerleading and rooting for him. And we started dating, not real steady, but we started dating. We dated for 5 years, and then we were finally married in 1938. And we got married. The day we got married, he left for Honolulu. Came back a month later, and he was home for 2 weeks and went off for 6 months. And that was the way we started our life, just going from pillar to post, and it seemed to be that way until we finally landed in Kodiak. And he came up in 54, and the children and I came in 55, January of 55. And the reason for that is we had a tiny baby, and they wouldn't let us travel until we were 8 weeks old. And we had to come by ship. We had no planes coming into Kodiak at that time. And the ship MSTS came into the station at Kodiak. And Tim met us there, and because our quarters were not yet ready for us here on the base, we had to live in town. And we started into town. And at that time, the old road was still in existence. We didn't have the road across the slide area. You had to travel the road that went across the side of the mountain. And that thing looked like it was about big enough for one car. It was a little bit wider, but not much. And it had, on Kodiak, on the base side, it stopped just about where the State Highway Department is located now. And then that was the end of the Navy territory. Then the rest of it was kind of a no man's land until you got over where, about where the Kodiak Island, Kodiak transfer or oil tanks are located. And then it became Kodiak's problem. So in between, it was a no man's land. And when we would have a snow slide or a mud slide, the base would furnish the equipment, the town would furnish the manpower, and kept that area clean so the people could keep going. Because we had a lot of people who lived in town. Navy people, Coast Guard, yeah, we even had a few Coast Guard, but a lot of them lived in town. And because you had to be a certain rate before you could live on the base itself. And so we had, they would take turns cleaning up that no man's land. Until along about 1957, they had a bad landslide. And the only way you could get people back and forth was to take a fishing boat from Gibson's Cove and run it into Kodiak. And the state, the road commissioner came over for a visit one time, and the only way he could get into town was go by boat or go by helicopter or something else. They got the new road at that time. that was. Then we left. See, we were here for almost 3 years, and we left and went to California for almost 3 years for Naval Ammunition Depot, and we came back in 1960. And when we were here the first time, we moved into JOQIA, and it was right across from the hospital. And I worked at the hospital at that time. And then when we came back, and we had 5 children at this time.
Were any of your children born?
No. Our youngest one was just 8 weeks old when we came up here. And so then we had, and all 5 children, and Tim and I lived in one of those small duplexes. We had our 3 daughters in the big bedroom, and we had the 2 boys in the small bedroom, and then Tim and I had the back bedroom. And then when we came back the second time,
we were living in a fourplex on the circle. And then our oldest boy had to go downstairs in the basement because he was what, 14? No. He was about 16 and a half. But he had to go downstairs because he didn't have his parents. And see, we lived there until 62. Tim retired, and they went to India, and they lived here just a short time, and they wanted just to move back on base, and they lived there to make the leaves. And we lived there until 1973, or 1976. And we lived back in the town of Papa's home.
Had you worked for the Red Cross before?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I've worked for the Red Cross for 43 years. I worked as a volunteer until 1961. In 1961, I became a professional. And then I retired. I retired in 1975, I think it was. Well, I retired simply because they decided they were going to close. They were going to close that Red Cross here on the base, and we had to close the station as it was known at that time. And then I continued as a volunteer because Captain Clark was here at the time, and I started working strictly as a volunteer because I felt that we needed Red Cross on the base. We were taking away from. And he felt the same way. So Charlie Clark started writing letters to National Headquarters. The Admiral got in on it. He started sending letters to headquarters. And finally what they did was they decided that in order to keep National Headquarters from closing us down when they cut back, they would have us work through the chapter. So now we work through the chapter. However, in a sense, we do. I still work out of Elmendorf. I'm still considered a professional, even though I've come back, I've retired and come back again. But my immediate superior is in Elmendorf, not the base, or not Kodiak at all. And so, per se, it's been since 1961, and even though we had closed the office out as a national at that time, it was still Red Cross, and I worked as a volunteer for several, about 2.5 years, and then we finally got established again. When you say that you became a professional, did they send you for training? Was it done here, or was it on the mainland? What kind of training did they
do? It was for training to work with service to military personnel, strictly working with military people. And how to write loans, how to provide counseling that they sometimes require, and things of this nature. How we provide loans for them, the purposes of the loan, we have to distinguish because whether they're family assistance, whether they're emergency leave, or whether they're just basic maintenance. Mm-hmm. And what we do is if one of the service wives, the ship is out, and she runs out of money, she doesn't get her allotment check. That's part of basic maintenance, and we provide money for that. It's all in a form of a loan, unless there's dire circumstances, and then we can make a grant. The most of it is strictly a loan.
So you did a lot of person-to-person work?
Very much so. Very much so.
What kind of a operation did the Red Cross have when you first got here?
It's pretty much the same thing.
Same as it is now.
Exactly.
Yes. There hasn't been that much updated type of communication.
No, it's the same type of thing. Mm-hmm. It's the same, and this is the same thing no matter where you go, wherever we have a service to military personnel on a military base. And we all work the same way. And I could leave here and go to another station and step right into. It would be that familiar. I'd be doing the same identical thing I'm doing here. And I could be transferred, except that
made myself immobile because of having a home here and having, you know, being here with Tim. But it was strictly my choice to become immobile. Otherwise, they could have transferred me anyplace. But when we first came to Kodiak, there were no paved streets. The only paved streets were on the base. And when you walk down the main street, the way we know it today is not the way it was then. And there were still cows wandering down the main street. And eventually they decided to pave it and put in curbings. And then they brought in parking meters. We had 10 parking meters. And if you overstayed, you know, ran out of time, you paid 25-cent fine. But let me go back a bit. The first time we came up here, we came from Newport, Rhode Island. And I went up to get a driver's license, and we were still a territory at the time. And the building was located where the Elks Club is now, used to be a hill. And the jail was up on top of that hill. And then this little tiny building, it seemed to me that it was joint library and minor things. But they told me that's where I had to go get my driver's license. So I walked in, and there was a woman sitting there, and she was writing. She never bothered to look up. And she said, "May I help you?" And she continued writing, and I said, "Yes, I came to get a driver's license." And she said, "Do you drive?" And I said, "Yes." And she's still writing and looking down. And finally she said, "50 cents, please." And when I gave her the 50 cents, she looked up at me and said, "That's good for as long as you're here." And that was it. And I walked out. And so I never had to take a road test or anything in town. But that was my first experience with the things of business and whatnot in town. It was a rude awakening because I fully expected to have to make have a road test and all that I didn't care for. But in any case, we had Northern Commercial, and we had Wadlinger's Drugstore, and we had Mrs. Knockaway had a 5 and 10 cent store downtown, and we had another little makeshift store. We had Crafts, but Crafts was not located it was located in that general area, but it was just a small shop. But where Sublips is located, that had Crafts department store down there, and they had a little jewelry store that belonged to Knudsen's. It was a jewelry store, and it was a photography shop, and all kinds of little if you wanted something special for a party, they have that too under the counter. But just as you turn the corner off of the main street, what is now known as East Rezanov, and you turn down what is known today as Marine Way, the house that it's located over on Rezanov now, and I don't know who lives in it, but it's on a corner, and it's a two-story house, and that used to be right on the corner where you turn down onto what is now known as Marine Way, and they had a little gift shop in there, and Marge and John, I can't think of their last name, anyway, they owned it, and she had the gift shop, and then eventually they put in a clothing shop up on this second floor, but she had everything in that gift shop. They eventually retired from here and moved over to Anchorage. And the high school where our oldest daughter went to school was located down where it was the Center Street Service Station. What is it now? It's that rental right there at the corner. Well, the high school used to be just above that. There was a little hill, and the high school used to be located up there. It was a red building, and that's where our oldest daughter went to school. She started high school there. And when she went through, when she became a freshman, they had to push a clove of garlic with their nose down the hall.
You were talking about getting your driver's license. How hard was it to get a vehicle in at that point?
Did we brought our own. We brought our own up on the ship.
Just right with you on the
mm-hmm.
ship?
Yeah.
Were there many? Let's see, that was 40 or 50?
Yeah, there were a lot of people that came up.
A lot of cars?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of people that came up. And when you came by, what they did was the trips would alternate. Now, when we came up by way of Whittier. And we stopped in Whittier, where they let a lot of the Air Force and Army people off and picked up a lot of the people who were returning to the States, or to the lower 48. And then, okay, they stopped at Whittier, and then they came to Kodiak, and then down. The next trip they came, they would come to Kodiak first, and then they would go to Whittier, and then south. But the only way that the people who were over on the mainland, in either Elmendorf or Fairbanks, the Wainwright area, the only way that they could get a vehicle was to have it come up by ship, and they had to take the train from Anchorage down to Whittier. And when you pulled in there, you saw cars that had been there for months, and of course this was in the dead of winter, and they were buried in snow. And but we came up, and people got off there, and then we came to Kodiak, and we had our car taken off here. And then that was the beginning of our tour in Kodiak, and we didn't have any idea what to expect. We had only returned from Germany just a few months, a year or so before. So we had no idea what, you know, going from a foreign country and coming to Alaska, which at that time was still kind of, and we were looking for the rate of exchange. What is postage? Do we have to pay do we buy United States stamps, or do we buy Alaska? What do we buy? We knew nothing about Alaska.
Were you here when you were?
We were here for the earthquake.
Well, were you here when they
became a
state
in 1959? No, we came back in 60.
So you missed. I was curious what it was like here in Kodiak, what people.
We came back in 1960, and it became a state in 1959.
What kind of work did you do with the Red Cross after the quake and the tsunami?
Exactly what I'm doing now, and incidentally, that was an exciting period because there were two of us working. I had an immediate superior who was here at the time. He was the station manager, which I am now. But I was his assistant then, and he was out. He had been to ADAC on a visit, and he was on his way back to Kodiak, and he got as far as Shemya, and then there was no plane. Then we had the earthquake. He was stuck at Shemya. I was stuck here. The people in Kodiak, the Red Cross people in Kodiak, had never experienced anything like this. I had never experienced anything to that degree. And so we immediately did what we could do. Pardon. We started taking messages from all the people who wanted to let their families know that they were okay. And we were located, our office was located behind what is now known as the gym. There was a little building back there, and the chaplains were there. The post office was there, and my office was there. And when the quake occurred, I happened to be here in town, and where we were living with that transition to a period. Tim was out at Chiniac, and we got back. Let's see, we were home. The children had been to church. We had come home and prepared dinner. And while I was preparing dinner, it's when we looked out and saw all the poles are going up and down. They're not going sideways. They're going up and down. And we knew then that we were in for trouble. And so I got that evening. We had to evacuate. We went up Pillar Mountain, the children and I. And we walked out of the house, left the house wide open. Tim and I had celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary just a few months, November before this occurred. And the only thing I could think about that, got to have ready cash. So we had 25 silver dollars inside. Of course, I had my checkbook and all. I grabbed the 25 silver dollars, grabbed my children, and we headed out and up the hill. Our two older girls were married at that time, so I only had three at home. And we went up the hill, walked off, and left the house wide open with cameras, Tim's guns, fur coats, everything. Forgot all about it. And then early the next morning, the water had subsided, and I said, I'd get to the base. And I went back to the base, and that was the last I saw my family for a week. We didn't know whether he was dead or alive because he was out in Chiniac, and we had no way of getting in touch with him. But as I said, we started taking all these calls from people on the base, people in town wanting to send messages to their families. So we were typing out messages through the Comstag, and then we were sending letters. And as I would get the letters ready, the boys from the post office would put them in an envelope, put a stamp on them, and put them in a large bag. And we had a plane going out the next day, and it was going back to Whitby. And so all these letters, bags of letters that we had, were on that plane. And well, I would say probably 3 weeks later, I started getting many, many phone calls from people wanting to know why their request had not been honored. And I said, what do you mean? Well, I thought you sent messages to our families. Well, we did. You know, those that we put in communication, that we went out by Navy communications, fine, that was no problem. But those that we sent out by mail, they didn't get. And we couldn't understand it, so the post office started to trace it. And they found that when the plane landed at Whitby Island, they had taken all these bags of mail and put them into a safe. And they were completely forgotten until the post office put a tracer on them. And so they came back, and the post office had put up an apology in the paper. So that stating that we had done our job, but it was the people on the plane who had erred. They had just taken the mail and put it in a safe. They were just glad to be back where they could walk on ground that wasn't shaking like it was here, because it was still shaking here.
So everything was done by mail, then? Or anything that wasn't official.
Yeah. We did send a lot of things out by Navy communication, but we were getting messages through Navy communications that would be yards long, because they were going to Seattle, and then Seattle King County chapter was wiring them up to us, and it was all duplication. Almost every bit of it was duplication of letters and other messages that we were receiving. So we were trying to get contact with the people in town, and we were combining our efforts and sending out their messages as well as our own. And then we started getting in all these clothes. Can you imagine in March in Alaska, where it's cold, and we are receiving boxes of clothes that are sunsuits, they're sandals, their cocktail dresses, anything that would do for summer wear. It's what we were receiving up here. We'd get a few sweaters, maybe a few heavy clothes, but most of it was just junk. A lot of it was just junk. It's, as a matter of fact, we had a big bonfire later that summer, because all of this stuff was stored up in the attic that Jack, I can't think of his name now. Anyway, he had a garage downtown right across from Jack Mann, and that everything was stored up in his attic. And we took out everything that was usable, and the rest of it, we just had a big bonfire and burned it all up. Nothing we could do.
What was it? Was there much change for you, at least with the Red Cross, when the Navy left and the Coast Guard started?
No.
Everything was pretty much the same.
Everything continued right on the same. Wonderful, wonderful people. I think that Captain Clark was such a superb person. He was just wonderful, and his wife. But the first people that came, let's see, we had Oh, I can't even think of the first captain's name. I just drew a blank on his name. I don't remember. But Charlie, I think, was the second, or it was the third one that was here. And he was just great to work with. They were all very nice to work with, but he was a special person.
Were there any other big events like the earthquake that you were involved in?
No.
That's pretty much
that was pretty much it. That was enough.
That was enough.
Well, you know, when we were here the first time, we would have these evacuations, and we would have drills, but they weren't for tsunami. They were for bombs. We had shelters. The BOQ was a shelter down below, down in the basement. There was a shelter up in the building 12, was it? It's down going down towards the air station, the big concrete building.
26.
Building 26. Those were all shelters, and we would have evacuations, and where we would have to go into town, and we had houses and Aleutian homes that were designated safe areas for us, and people who lived in those homes knew which families to expect. And we were like sitting ducks if we had really had a bombing at all. Here we are taking this little tiny road that was running between the base and town, and all of us families are lined up on this road getting into town. But I must say this much, one time we had a drill and we evacuated in 20 minutes off that base.
The whole base
in 20 minutes we moved. But we had, and the base wasn't like it is today. The road that we had to take when we came out the main gate, which was pretty much where it is now, but we'd have to go down, and then you know where Peterson is, the road that goes up the hill right close to that's the road we took. And then some of us would get up on Aviation Hill, which was a safe period, but most of us were sent into town. Well, then later on, they took them out to magazines out in the magazine area instead of taking them into town. Which, frankly, right now, Peterson is no place for us, the people on the base, for a safe spot. I mean, I shouldn't be saying this, but it's true.
Okay.
Because if we were to have a major wave, that's just like a bowl. We belong up in Aviation Hill, or out further. We don't belong.
Did they used to evacuate people at T1? Isn't that something that I thought I'd do?
At C1?
T1, out where the Comstay is now?
They, up on the hill, yes. We've gone up on the hill, which is a lot of times. And there were barracks and things up there that we could go to. But most of us were sent out either to Aleutian homes or out to the magazines.
We were talking earlier, before we turned the tape on, about the club, you were saying that when you were first here and your children were involved,
mm-hmm.
dancing and all. Could you talk a little more about that again? Yeah. That you had out on Nyman's Peninsula, you said it was a...
Oh, on Nyman's Peninsula?
Yeah.
What
kinds of things were out there?
Okay. Well, number one, up on Aviation Hill, we had a Rotten Gun Club, and all of our children were involved in the gun club, and they had an old retired Marine sergeant, and he would teach adults and children, and the children would have to know how to take a gun apart and put it together again before they were ever permitted to fire it, and then that was an excellent thing for, and all of our children are all sharpshooters because they took this training. And down on took dancing lessons from Betty Reed, who now lives in Chiniac. And that was located up. It was known then as Civilian Hill, because it was mostly occupied by civilian employees who were working on the base. But the school was located in a duplex that was located just up from Peterson School, up that little road that goes up to into that housing area, and it was located on the right-hand corner. And then when we had the performances down, the performances were down on the main pier, and that little theater was moved by Captain Strickler and Tim, and it was moved from what is now known as Nimitz Park down to this location on the pier. And they had, it was just like a theater. They had a stage and seats. They moved all the seats in and arranged them and everything. And that's where they had all the little theater performances down there. Also down there, they had a booth. And whenever any of the MSTS ships or any of the other ships would come in, the Red Cross would be down there with cookies and donuts and hot coffee for all the people that were on the ships. And they would come down, either the passengers or the people who were aboard the ship would come down and have a snack and go back aboard and get ready to leave. It was neat. I mean, it was great. We had so much cooperation and so many people who were interested in helping and doing these things. But going back to the little theater, I just learned 2 weeks ago that Marion Strickler, who was her husband was a Navy captain here, and she was the one who started the little theater on the base. And I just learned that she is still living in San Diego, and I didn't know this until 2 weeks ago. I thought she had passed away, but she was still alive. In fact, her daughter, her youngest daughter, was up here for, she didn't come up for a visit for anyone specific. She simply came back to Kodiak. She's married now and has a family of her own, but she came back to Kodiak because she wanted to see what it was like, and that was this past summer. I didn't know that until then. But after the earthquake, that part of the island sunk. And as you note, when you go down there now at high tide, the water is awfully high. Awfully high.
So there was they lost a lot of elevation there.
Yeah. We had quarters down on Niman's Peninsula. We had a TV station on Niman's Peninsula. When you first, where the powerhouse is now located, well, is located, just beyond that, there were quarters, duplexes. And then there's a little one road that kind of goes up and around, and that's where the radio and TV station was located up there. And we had, and at that time we had the bowling alley down there. The bowling alley was down around the end of the point. And we had the special services officer was getting ready to leave. He was being transferred, and he had a little VW, and he had sold it, but the person he had sold it to said, well, you can use it for a little while. And so when first wave came in, or the first swelling came in, he made a hurry-up trip down to the bowling alley to see what damage had been done. And when he came back out, his VW was floating out in the bay. Another wave had come in, not quite as large, but big enough to carry his car out. And the insurance company, nothing, he couldn't get any money back on it. He had to pay back the money that he had been given for the car to the individual who bought it. And he lost his insurance, which of course at that time probably wouldn't have been more than about $50 because the car wasn't that new. But
so things like the Billiken and all that down there, there are much.
Those are all things that were built later.
But they were built to replace things that were.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we used to bowl in, before they built the bowling alley down on Niman's Peninsula, we used to bowl in the basement of the exchange, but is now the gym building. But that was the exchange at that time. The bowling alley was downstairs. Off to, well, the back part was the gymnasium downstairs. But if you went down the stairs and turned immediately to your left and kept going to your left, then you have the bowling alley down there. We had something like six lanes, six alleys. It was fun. It was great.
They're still working on trying to put a swimming pool.
Hmm?
I said they're still working on the swimming pool.
Oh, that, would you know that was where the theater is. That was to be a pool.
Is that really a true story?
That is a true story. And the person that drew up the plans was a very good friend of ours. They're gone now. But that was to be a swimming pool. then our theater burned down, and they decided that the theater was needed more than a pool. So that was the reason they converted it to a pool. And Marty Gunderson, whose husband was, had, they had been stationed here twice, and Marty was the one that named it the Billiken. And she was quite a gal. But they had a contest, and it was Marty who won the contest for the name.
So it was actually being built as a pool when they decided to change it?
Exactly.
It never actually served as a pool?
Never became a pool at all. And you can tell when you go in and look at the way the construction of it, that's it.
What year was that?
Oh, shoot, that had to be, in the early 60s. Yeah, because he was commissioned by that time, and it was after he was commissioned that, it was in the early 60s.
It was before the earthquake?
No,
or after
the earthquake, See, it doesn't seem possible.
Things to make sure that... Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, how many years was it that you were gone between your two tours?
Almost 3 years.
3 years. Did you notice a big difference when you were gone? When you came back, did things change much?
No. The change came after the earthquake. Up to that time, things were pretty much the same way. The bars were open all night, and you could walk down the street any hour of the day or night, and if you saw natives who were inebriated, they would nod their heads and greet you, but they would keep on going. They never assaulted you or were insulting to you in any way. After the earthquake, people didn't know about Kodiak until the earthquake. And after the earthquake, we have this influx of everything. And everything changed at that time. I mean, we never heard of people being raped. We never heard of young women being raped. We never heard of homes being broken into. We could go off and leave our house wide open. Couldn't do that today. Students who would come up in the summertime, they would come up in May. And they would live in the bunkers and things along the hillside so that they could work in the canneries to make their money so they could go back to school for another year with the money that they earned. And today they don't. There are no jobs for them anymore. The jobs are being taken by other people. None of the students can get the work that they used to have. But they used to sleep down on the beach. They would sleep in the bunkers. They would sleep. They'd pitch tents up on the hillsides, any place. I mean, they would go down to the laundromat to take a bath and to wash their clothes. But they had no running water, they had no heat, but they were willing to put up with all of this in order to make the money for school. You have to hand it to them that they were that eager for an education. And the money was good. Unfortunately, we don't have that now.
So actually, when you got here, I was just trying to. You were here after the first major population boom during the war, mm-hmm. That had already sort of tapered off. Mm-hmm. But I guess after the earthquake, then was it mainly people coming in to rebuild? Is that the?
And people came up to make easy money. And just we had, I get carried away.
Were you involved in any other groups besides the Red Cross? I mean, any of the with like the senior center or any other of the sort of groups that were starting up at that time, or was the Red Cross, your major?
Oh, no. We're Red Cross, and we were members of the original Flying Club on the base, both of us. And both belonged to Eastern Star in town. And we chaperoned at the teen club many, 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 many times because we had teenagers. And let's see, Theo Wise, and of course I had Theo Wise and we bowled, and I'm trying to remember, it just seemed like we were always going. We never did join the Pioneers Club as much as we would like to, because we feel that if we can't really put our whole heart and souls into things, we don't want to get involved in it. So we never got involved with it. We just figured that our time was taken up with Eastern Star and the wife of the Officers Club and our children and sorority. Those were my main interests.
Did you do much going out the road toward, you know, you said he was working at Chiniac a lot.
Did you
do a lot of stuff out the road?
Oh, yes. Right after the earthquake, we have property on at Chiniac. And right after the earthquake, we had another friend of ours who was a retired Navy captain who lived out, their property adjoined ours. And they were out of town at the time of the earthquake. So as soon as the roads were passable, our oldest daughter was living in Dutch Harbor, and she had left her little VW here with us. So we took the VW. Tim and I went out one day. Well, we had another friend with us, and she was a Navy nurse who was stationed here at the time. So we got in the car and we drove out, because we had to go out and check on Marty and Hopi and Spike's property. We weren't concerned about our own, but they had a home out there, and we didn't at the time. So we got out to Kelson, and the road that we would normally take was washed out, because it used to be when you got to the foot of Kelson Hill, you made a sharp left, and then you went along the beach until you got on the other side, and then you crossed a bridge. Well, they had already started cutting a road through, the back road that we presently know. And we got to the first bridge, and all they had across the bridge were railroad ties. And that was the first bridge, and the second one the same way. And then when we got over to the forks, where you went to the right to go to Passagshack, the left to go to Chiniac, we made the left-hand turn, but then we had no road. We had to go through the lake. And we would have to wait for low tide. And then we would go through the lake, and somebody was usually over on the other side with a pulley, and they would pull us ashore. And then we would go on out. We got out to Chiniac, and we would check on the property out there. We did this several times. But they had a small cabin down on the lake, Pony Lake. And at that time, they were not quite ready to build. They were starting to build up on their little hill. But they had a Navy wife and her husband. He was a commander, lieutenant commander on the base, and Elaine worked out at the tracking station. So at this particular time, she was staying at the cabin, and Ben would go out every weekend or maybe during the week and spend a couple of days out there too. But at this particular time, they were both in town, and fortunately, because the ice on Pony Lake had been lifted and then tossed and came down on the cabin and completely squashed them. The only thing that was standing that was upright was the freezer, and it had been moved from the cabin up against the hill where their home was to be built eventually. And that was standing right there by the hill, but the rest of it was just smashed. But they had, the water had just come in off the ocean through into the lake and then kind of swirled around and then back out again. We had all our lumber out there to build, and it was just swirled around, and it just... It was in pretty bad shape. We were just fortunate we didn't have a house at the time. But then when we got ready, this particular time, when we got ready to come back to Kodiak, we started down the hill. And of course, the only way we could get through, because the road we usually would take was washed out, we had to go along the beach. That's the same way we got in to begin with. And we got stuck in the sand. And we would go up and look for look for little pieces of wood, and we'd put a piece of wood in front of the wheel, and then we'd go a little bit further, and then move the wood around, and kept, that's just the way we were progressing, right? Just moving the wood along. And then finally, some boys from Little Navy came by, and they asked if we were having problems, and they could see that we were having problems. So they bodily picked up the car and moved it up on firmer ground so we could head her on back onto Kodiak. But then when we got back to the lake again, we had to ford the creek, ford the lake. And,
so you couldn't just go out the road for the day,
no,
obviously.
No, you had to time it.
At least, you had to spend at least 2 days.
No, you had to go at low tide, and then you had to return at low tide. Yeah, it may be 12 hours, but that was the only way you were able to get out there. Yeah. See, it was quite an experience. And then one time we came back, and we got right over there by Woman's Bay, and of course the road wasn't built up there, and it was underwater. And we were, what were we driving? Were we driving the VW at that time, too?
There was a bunch
of kids were in the VW in front of us, and their car stopped on them. And instead of just waiting, or just kind of starting trying to move otherwise, or waiting for somebody to pull them out, they opened the doors. And a whole lot of people swarmed, swishing in on them.
VW will float.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. So, I just totally off the track, getting back to there was one question I wanted to ask you when you were talking about the earthquake, and how long was it before your life, say, your work life with the Red Cross, how long was it before that went back to normal? How long did it take you to sort of sort through all
that? Well, it was, I say, for a week we stayed right in the office. The boys in the galley would bring our meals over to us, because the chaplains were there too, and the boys in the post office, we all were. And somebody, I don't know who it was, brought around little space heaters for us, and we had sleeping bags. And we just stayed in that building for a good week. And by this time, our oldest son was able to get back and forth, and he was giving us reports on the family in town. And Tim, I think it was about a week later, then I learned that he had started in town. I've always given him a bad time about forgetting things, but I swore then that I would never give him a bad time again, because he had started into town, and he got right to the Kelson just before you got to Kelson, and was going to go across the bridge, and he couldn't remember whether he had done something out of Chiniac, and he turned around and went back. And that was when the big wave came in, and it killed 1, 2, 3, 4 people.
Oh, that was the last big one that came in?
What had happened was that it came in with such force, and there was a Navy wife and her son who were coming into town, and her husband was there. I think he was driving another car, and the wave got them and pulled them out. The other was Mr. It was the Bojan boy and Mr. Curry, the Currys had a house right at the foot of Calson Hill, and he and the little Bojan boy had all been on a beach party. And they had gone back to they were over on the other side of the Calson Bay bridge, and they had started back to the house to pick up something, and they were heading back again when this happened. They found their bodies up, way up on the other side of the, they'd been pushed a good mile in. So many things. It's so many memories come flooding back. You start remembering those things and how sad they were.
Do your children have vivid memories of that? Were they old enough to really?
Oh, yes. Our oldest daughters, both of our oldest girls were married. And our second daughter lived right there in the little house where at the corner of Rezanov and what is now known as Marine Way, where Jack Mann is located now. She had a home right there. And we had, the younger children and I had been to church and stopped at Crafts, which was just across the street. And she was pregnant at the time, so I'd stopped to look at a dress for her, and I found a real cute one and went up to let her know that I wanted her to go down and try it on. And then the little ones and I came on home. Well, right after that we had the wave. She never got down there, but she and her husband stood down there on the at the boat harbor, and they took pictures. And fortunately, our oldest daughter and her husband came by and saw them standing there, you know, oblivious to what could have happened, and just bodily put them in the car and said, let's get out of here, let's get to high ground. And so they headed for Pillar Mountain. Well, I didn't even hear the police coming through telling everybody to head for high ground until the boys came to the house and they said, Billy, what are you doing here? Get up on Pillar Mountain. They kept saying the police were going around saying there was a 100-foot wave. We never heard a sound. Never heard a sound.
Obviously, it was not the sophisticated siren system you have now.
No. They didn't have anything like that. They depended strictly on the police. And so they went around. But and people going up Pillar Mountain, honestly, the cars were just... They, you know, everybody, which one after the other, people were just stopping any place and then walking the rest of the way because they couldn't drive through. So the hill was just alive with people. And we sat up there and we could watch everything floating down the channel, see lights, and the whole town changed. I mean, when I'm trying, you know, if we could draw a picture of the way it was, because it was so unique, and it was a lovely little fishing town when we first came here. It really was. It was so different. You went down this little main street, drugstore on the corner, and you made a left-hand turn, and there was Wilton White's mother's home, and then the bank, and then you made another right-hand turn, and that went, oh, and there was a hotel on the corner. And you went on down the hill, and there was Dowling and Anderson's department store, and the museum, which at that time was not being used as a museum, it was being used for storage, I think. And then all along that area down there, where the Chamber of Commerce and buildings and things are, those were all little piers and a couple of little restaurants, quick food restaurants down there that were locally owned. And it was just so different. And now they've made it into a modern little town. Not really what I want to say. But it lost a lot of charm. It did. I loved it the way it was, even though it was not paved. When we first moved out here, it was still, we had no paved streets. I mean, this was all dust. There was only one other house right across the street from us at the time. And now look at it.
I was thinking that tonight as we drove in, that it's such a, I never remember that Larch Street is so long, driving in half it.
Yeah. And so many people cut down their trees. We used to have so many trees. Our trees that we had on our hill were blown down. Because so many people, when they built, they just cut the trees down and left it barren. And so the trees had no protection. So when we had that freak windstorm, our trees were blown down. We had one of them into our dining room. People on the other side of this, not this house, but the other one, their trees came down into their daughter's bedroom. Just knocked out everything. I just got a story.
Well, you.
How was your beauty?
Saying, you know, talking about it changed so much, you know, when they, after the earthquake, when they started and planning the urban renewal, as they called it, mm-hmm. You know, that's basically what you got, was urban renewal. I assume, and just from what little I've read, they talk about, you know, quite a bit of discussion back and forth, and I don't know, call it fighting or not, mm-hmm. which direction they would go.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember much
my
of
mother and
of
dad?
That?
My mother and dad came up.
I had been listening.
As, that summer, they came up here and to see the damage that had been done, and they decided they were going to spend a year here, and they were both very much involved in what was going on in town, with the politics of town, and they kept stating that they felt that the town of Kodiak should be rebuilt out Menashka Bay, you know, in that area. And everybody kept saying, oh no, the winds are too bad off the bay area, that would never do for the town to be built out there. Well, now you see where the town is moving, it's all moving out that way. And they thought that they should keep the downtown strictly commercial and fishing and things of this nature. Of course, we didn't have Near Island. We had Near Island, but we had no connection with it as we do today. And then when that bridge was built, they called it the Bridge to Nowhere because it stopped right on the other side. There were no roads or anything. But the whole town, it just began to rebuild, and they changed all the streets, the direction of the streets and everything, and and that's when they built Rezanov and took it up the hill. Because when we first came here, you came up Mill Bay, and then you went up to what is the elementary school, used to be the high school, and Rezanov didn't exist. We could have brought land over there for $800. And you couldn't touch it for that now. But that there was no road over there at all. And where Helen Hall and the mayor lives and all that, that road was not there in any way. And the hospital was down off of Mission, Griffin Memorial Building.
Yeah.
And that was where the hospital was located. I mean, there were very few roads.
Was there a lot of damage to the hospital during the...
No, because of their location, there was very little. They were right on the channel, and the footwater came up, it didn't do much damage to them. They were very fortunate, actually. But anyway, going back to rebuilding the town, we really felt that because the town was, if they wanted to make it a safe town as far as another tidal wave and all, they should build further out, not so close to the water. And we had safes floating in the middle of the street after the wave. I mean, that's the reason I mentioned that, because the Elks Club was almost inundated with water. The water was all running down into the basement. People got out just in time because that wave came in and just filling up down there. And we had the safe, but we just strongly felt that the town should, that any businesses of the nature that we have now should be built further out in the higher ground. Keep the fishing boats and things down there where they belong. Even though one of the fishing boats did end up down up there where where that rental agency is located. They kept saying, Salif, where are you? And he said, would you believe I'm tied up to a telephone pole just below the high school? And yes.
Did that get very rancorous? Was there a lot of argument?
Yeah. The people didn't want to move out. They wanted to rebuild right back down the same area. Just like the people in Tennessee Valley, you know, places like that, they get wiped out with a flood every year and they go back and rebuild again. Same thing. But they poured a lot of money into it and rebuilt down there. And that's fine. That's great. If this is where they want to be, that's their prerogative. But now you see all the businesses are beginning to move out. They're all moving out towards Menashka. But it just seemed to make a lot of sense to do that. Even though it is going into bear country, bear preserve.
It's a whole other problem.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. See, I feel like we should give your your vocal cords a break. Well, is there anything I didn't, anything you want to talk about that I,
no, I can't think
that you've
of
been
anything.
Involved in?
I can think of so many things, and you know, when you're not here, and then when we start talking, then I, what I should have done was write down a lot of things, knowing you were coming, but I didn't, so.
Yeah, one thing you were saying, when you first came here, you said you worked at the hospital?
And yeah, the Naval Hospital.
The Naval Hospital.
Mm-hmm. Which was located right across from the house.
I had to laugh tonight. Before I came, I was looking at a photograph of that from the air, and boy, that was must have been some building.
It was a wonderful building. I never will understand why they tore it down, because it wasn't that old. I mean, what money they put into that clinic, they could have put into the surgical room, the OR and everything, and because most of the work that was done in there had been volunteer work. The CBs scrounged, and they got paneling, and they got all kinds of things to put in that hospital to save money. And we had OBGYN was, or the maternity ward was upstairs, and then the other wards were down. So we had a complete hospital, We had surgery, we had optical services, we had dental services, everything were located in there. And the only time that anybody came into town were the doctors or the a nurse anesthetist who came into town on because they needed somebody here at the hospital in town as on an emergency. But otherwise, everything was confined to our base. And it was very, very nice. We had pediatricians, we had obstetricians, we had dentists, we had surgeons, we had general practitioners.
It was a bigger active
much
duty bigger, population.
A much too. Larger facility, yeah. But of course, again, remember though that we had Marines, we had Navy, we had Coast Guard, we had Air Force, and we had some Army. So we had a lot of people in. Not many more people.
Was Fort Greeley still?
Hmm?
Was Fort Greeley still?
That was just all part of well, we still had buildings there, but that
were
left over from the Army when it was known as Fort Greeley.
That was not active then?
No, it wasn't active at all. That by that time, they had a few quarters and they had moved some of the military families in there. And they were beginning to realize that there wasn't enough housing on the base for them. And the housing that was in town was so minimal and so expensive that a lot of our people couldn't afford it. And of course, when you came up here, you came up on invitational orders. If you brought your family up, that was your problem. You didn't get quarters on base. And you, until such time as you were rated and could qualify for quarters. But otherwise, you had to make do with whatever was available in town. Lake Louise was nice. They still had quarters there that were left over from World War II. But
it was Fort Greeley then.
Hmm?
It was Fort Greeley then.
It was still known as Lake Louise. That portion over there, Fort Greeley was just that area where Nimitz Park is located. And the chapel that we have in town, on base, that was moved from Fort Greeley.
In fact, in church just a couple weeks ago, they had a little thing in the bulletin talking about the history of the
mm-hmm.
building.
Yeah, that was moved in from Fort Greeley. And when it was first brought on the base, it was the Catholic chaplain. The Protestant services were held at the Chiefs Club up on Aviation Hill. And it got to be a standing joke, you know, in the winter months, that they didn't have many services because nobody could make it up the hill. So then they finally decided to bring it down and make the chapel a joint chapel, which makes sense. And of course, then there was talk of building another chapel, having a community center, as we do now, there, and then another chapel being built adjoining that. So the one could be Catholic and the other would be a non-denomination. that. And that may still come to pass. I was talking to the captain the other day, and he said that we were going to have a lot of changes, even our building. We're going to be moved over. I guess we're going to be over near the child care center. And it's going to be, it's someplace in that area, and it's going to be all just community and work life as they're being known now, and just no longer family services. But all of us who are Red Cross, family services, drug and alcohol, and the chaplains will all be located right there together, but in a new building, something like $5 million buildings.
Is that going to be where the old hospital
1995.
Was?
It's over in that area.
In that mm-hmm. area.
And he said by 1995 that would be ready.
You will have traveled quite a way from getting off that boat.
Oh, you better believe it. But you know, prior to that, we, our own life, I mean, we had just to delve back a little bit, being raised in the Navy. I lived in China for 3 years with my parents. My sister was born there, and we lived in the Philippines. And then Tim and I, after in 1949, we went to Europe, and we lived in Europe for almost 3 years. And we went over right after the war, and when the rebel was still in existence, you know, he met us in Bremerhaven, and we drove down to Wiesbaden, or just outside of Wiesbaden, where he was stationed. And where we, our home was, and we, our home was located in El Villa, and we had a 26-room villa. Can you imagine that? We lived in a 26-room villa. Yeah, exactly. And but it was the most wonderful experience, and the people. You couldn't ask for more wonderful people. And we still keep in touch with a lot of them. Because they were so good to us. And I can remember one day the girls worked for us. I was going into the base and to do some shopping, and I asked if there was anything I could pick up for them. Pick up some lipstick, if I could pick up hosiery or something. No, Frau Rautzen. No. I said, why? Oh, they would think that we were the soldiers' girlfriends. They were big, wonderful people. My only regret of all the time we were in the service was I never got through the Panama Canal. Isn't that silly? I always wanted to go through the Panama Canal. Never made it. You can do your now.
Okay. I think we'll turn this off and give everybody.